from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to Washington Watch. It's Thursday here in D.C. on a cloudy and cold afternoon. Merry Christmas to all of you. And we'd like to start with what's on everybody's mind, which is impeachment. Now that President Trump has been impeached by the House, it's supposed to go to the Republican-controlled Senate for a trial on whether or not to remove him from office. However, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has refused to send Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell the formal articles of impeachment. What happens next? Well, in just a minute, I'll talk with Tom Gipping, who is Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. In my second segment, Travis Weber, FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, will look back on the battle in the appropriation bills this year between Democrats and President Trump over the protection of the unborn, marriage, and sexuality. At the bottom of the hour, yet another elementary school has tried to pull a fast one, this time in North Manchester, Indiana, allowing a boy who identifies as a girl to go into the girls' bathrooms. Nate Gebhardt, who is a Christian father of four daughters, was more than upset, and we'll talk to him about how he mobilized other parents to fight the insanity at their local public school. And in my last block, students' test scores remain unchanged after decades of federal intervention in education and billions of dollars. I'll talk with Lindsay Burke, a Heritage Foundation fellow, who will reveal the reasons why the federal government should not dictate education policy. As a reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Go there for more resources on today's show and information on our guests. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins or me, if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. I'm pleased to be sitting in for Tony, the Director of Partnerships here, speaking to you and making another request because we are at the end of our calendar year. So partner with us, won't you? Continue to make a difference together with us in 2020, where the stakes will be high. When you give before December 31st, your gift will be doubled, thanks to a generous year-end challenge match. Help us advance faith, family, and freedom for the sake of America. To donate, visit our podcast site, TonyPerkins.com. That's TonyPerkins.com. Well, the inevitable happened. As was anticipated, President Donald Trump was impeached on Wednesday. And for the first time, third time rather, in the nation's history, the House of Representatives voted to impeach a sitting president, acting after a day-long debate on whether Trump violated his oath in pressuring Ukraine to damage his political opponent, Joe Biden. Now, Trump was impeached on two articles. The first vote was 230 to 197 and accused him in the article of abusing power. It was almost entirely on party lines and was followed quickly, and by quickly, I mean within 5 minutes, by a second article. 229 to 198 was the vote. This time, it accused the president of obstructing Congress. The one vote difference was that of Democrat Jared Golden of Maine, who voted yes on abuse of power and no on obstruction. No Republicans voted against Trump, as was also anticipated, and two Democrats, Jeff Van Drew of New Jersey, who's expected to actually switch parties soon, and Colin Peterson of Minnesota, voted with Republicans against both articles. One Democrat, Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, also a presidential candidate for the Dems, only voted present. Now, the trial in the Republican-controlled Senate on whether to remove the president from office will begin sometime, we think, in early January. But here to help me break that down is Tom Gipping, Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Tom, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get to the actual process of impeachment and what should happen next, can you break down for us these two articles, one, abuse of power, and the other, obstruction of Congress? They sound criminal. Are they significant somehow?
Well, those are just labels. So I wouldn't put too much stock in that particular phrase. Each of the articles details the conduct that House Democrats believe amounts to an impeachable offense. In the first article, that's what we've been talking about for the last, you know, couple of months, where it accuses President Trump of soliciting foreign interference in the 2020 presidential election. And this has to do with his interactions with Ukraine, trying to get them to conduct investigations into corruption. And they say that he did that with what it calls corrupt motive. The second article has to do with, you know, during the investigation, House Democrats wanted certain executive branch officials to testify, and Trump told them they could not, and they impeached him for it. As to the first article, you know, the central fact, the single fact that is at the heart of the entire impeachment narrative is this corrupt motive. In other words, what Trump did in terms of interacting with Ukraine by itself, there was nothing wrong with it whatsoever. It's the reason he did it that House Democrats say turns it all into an impeachable offense. Mm-hmm. And so the question for the Senate is there any evidence for that corrupt purpose? And then the second article, that to me is, and I worked in the United States Senate for 15 years, is almost, gosh, it verges on the silly, because the legislative branch does not get to simply demand anything that it wants from the executive branch. And when it does issue a subpoena and the executive branch says no, what they're supposed to do is go to court, go to the judicial branch to sort that out and to find out whether the executive branch has an obligation to comply. And they didn't do that. They just simply said, give us what we want or we'll impeach you, and then they did. And that's never happened before in American history where that kind of a charge, you know, was turned into an impeachable offense. So that's kind of the lay of the land as far as these two impeachment articles. And as I say, the Senate primarily has to decide whether there's any real evidence for that corrupt purpose behind what the president did with Ukraine.
And it's to the second article that myself, as an erstwhile attorney, I'm fascinated with, from the standpoint that there was such a major procedural hiccup. There was a subpoena issued. It was not judicially challenged. It never went to court to determine if the administration's compliance was required. So they sort of skipped over that step and then went directly to a second article of impeachment. So again, and I'm sure you know this, you've followed it closely, as have others at Heritage Foundation. To say this was partisan is potentially the understatement of this past year. We know precisely how they have played their hand. And in fact, the fact that Pelosi just today in a press conference said she has a spring in her step after impeachment. Or, for example, Representative James Clyburn went on CNN saying that he wanted to execute President Trump, leaves no bones about where they stand in terms of their political affiliations and their willingness, their desire, their excitement about impeaching this president. So do a comparison for us. How does the impeachment of Trump compare with the impeachments of, for example, Andrew Johnson in 1868 and Clinton, Bill Clinton, in 1998? How is it different or similar?
Well, the process, particularly in contrast with the Clinton impeachment and then not so much the Johnson impeachment, but remember 1974, Richard Nixon was under investigation for impeachment, and the House went through this same process. They didn't go all the way to a final vote because he resigned.
Right.
But the Clinton and Nixon impeachments were done very similarly. Both the Republican and Democratic members had similar authority to issue subpoenas and take other investigatory steps. Only the Judiciary Committee was authorized to do the investigation. In contrast, currently in the Trump impeachment, there were six different committees that were originally told to go and start investigating. And when it came to the hearings in the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees, the rules that they chose to adopt were skewed in favor of Democrats. So that, for example, Democrats could subpoena witnesses unilaterally, Republicans had to get Democrats' permission. Well, that's not the way that we've done any impeachment in American history, let alone something as grave as impeaching the president. So the process in the House was very different than it's been done in the past, and it was kind of rigged in favor of the president's opponents. And so it's, you know, doesn't surprise anybody that that kind of a process produces the results the Democrats wanted.
Now, what is the timeline for sending these articles of impeachment now passed by the House to the Senate? Because obviously we see what's a burgeoning stonewall here with Nancy Pelosi, who was pushing, and now is acting as if the House has all the time in the world. So what are we actually told? What do we know about how long this ought to take or when they ought to go over?
Well, there isn't a specific legal requirement that the House send the impeachment articles to the Senate within a particular period of time. The Senate does have a specific set of impeachment trial rules, and those rules say that the trial cannot begin until the articles of impeachment are sent over. And apparently, at least right now, the suggestion on the House side is that they use that to their advantage to say, you know, the trial can't start until we send you the articles. We're not going to do that until you promise to conduct the trial the way we want you to. I'm not sure what the calculus is behind that, because I don't think
Senate terribly
Republicans
vague.
I don't think Senate Republicans are sitting there saying we really want to put the president on trial, so whatever we have to do to, you know, get this going, let's do it. But I went and looked at, you know, you'd mentioned Bill Clinton and Andrew Johnson, the two presidents who were impeached. And President Johnson's trial began the day after his impeachment. Mm. And President Clinton, by the way, was impeached 21 years ago on the day that we're speaking, the 19th of December. And his trial began 18 days later, which is exactly the timetable that Mitch McConnell has suggested, you know, will be happening here. So that's the way that it's been done, and I think that's the way the Constitution expects, because the impeachment process is a single process with two steps. Once the House is done with their impeachment, they're supposed to hand it off to the Senate to do its part, which is to conduct the trial. That's the way it's supposed to be done. That's the way it's designed to be done, and we'll see if in the end it's done that way. There's been a lot of manipulation of this process along the way, and I hope this doesn't continue it.
So we have about a little bit close to a minute left here. Do you think, in your estimation, who studies this issue, that President Trump impeaching him was a misuse of the impeachment process?
I do, and I also believe that there is no evidence for the central fact at the heart of the entire impeachment case, and we'll see if the Senate agrees.
Tom Gipping, Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. For more information on the impeachment, on the process, and on Mr. Gipping, who is one of our smart friends, and we like to have him on, go to our website, TonyPerkins.com. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, we'll talk money, lots of it, appropriation bills, and what the Democrats tried to sneak in this year on Capitol Hill. We'll be right back.
Abortion is one of the most combative and sensitive moral and political questions in America today, even among Christians. There has been a renewed effort in theological liberal Christian circles to argue that the Bible does not oppose abortion. In light of these arguments, it is crucial for Christians to know what the Bible actually says about abortion. Does the Bible teach that life begins at conception or birth? Is abortion murder? In FRC's new publication titled Biblical Principles for Pro-Life Engagement, Personhood, Scripture, and Church History, author David Clawson addresses these questions with relevant passages in the Bible that inform how a Christian should think about abortion, the question of personhood, and a survey of how prominent church leaders have interpreted these passages throughout history. Learn more by visiting frc.org/unborn. That's frc.org/unborn.
Meadow Pollock was a high school senior who was tragically gunned down during the Parkland school shooting in Florida. In an emotional and gripping FRC Speaker Series event, her father, Andrew Pollock, and education expert Max Eden discussed the tragic massacre and the politically correct policies that allowed the Parkland shooting to happen. The Southern Poverty Law Center and the Obama administration promoted a false narrative that teachers and principals were racist and couldn't be trusted to enforce rules with consequences. Instead, they argued for healing circles and restorative justice. These policies enabled a psychopathic criminal to maintain a clean background and purchase a firearm used to murder 17 people at the high school. The Obama administration forced these leniency policies into hundreds of schools, serving millions of students across America. To listen to this event and to learn more, visit frc.org/speakers. That's frc.org/speakers.
Religious liberty is one of the most important yet misunderstood issues in America. There's a growing perception that protecting religious liberty is an attempt to lawfully allow bigotry and prejudice. Therefore, Christians need to be able to articulate with greater clarity and persuasiveness why they support religious liberty. Biblical Principles for Religious Liberty, Evidence from Scripture and Church History, is a new publication from Family Research Council that presents biblical and theological arguments for why religious liberty is worth defending and encourages Christians to engage in the fight to preserve America's first freedom. This publication presents key biblical texts that support a broad understanding of religious freedom and key theological arguments based on those texts. In an increasingly secular world, Christians must understand and advocate for religious liberty. Learn more by visiting frc.org/belief.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, sitting in for Tony Perkins on a cloudy Thursday afternoon in Washington, D.C. Well, money talks, and not only talks, it certainly makes for some very big policy changes in Washington. It only took the new Democrat majority in the House of Representatives one day into the 116th congressional session before they began to pick a fight over longstanding pro-life and pro-family policies in the annual appropriations bill, that bill that keeps the government up and running. In a move to reopen the government after a 35-day partial shutdown, Appropriations Chairwoman Nita Lowey, a Democrat from New York, introduced a funding bill with language to repeal the Mexico City policy. You'll remember that's the one that prohibits taxpayer funding for abortion providers overseas, as if we want to be sending our hard-earned tax dollars overseas to pay for their abortions. This move was just the beginning of a year-long battle to maintain values provisions in the funding bills with the new divided government. So today I've got in studio Travis Weber, FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs, to help me break down the appropriation bills and what Democrats tried to do but failed. Travis, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you very much.
All right. So talk to me a little bit about some of these policies. First, I want to talk about Trump's reaction to Nita Lowey's attempt to sort of shuttle this major anti-life provision through. She threw down the gauntlet, tried to roll back the Mexico City policy, one that is tremendously common sense and obviously highly protective of those who are overseas, who may need the added incentive of taking their own family planning into account, prevents our tax dollars from being sent there. So how did Trump respond when he realized that the congresswoman from New York was trying to roll it back?
So, Sarah, this appropriations history that we're referencing goes back earlier this year, and when this kind of developed on the life issue, Trump, you know, unknown certain terms, said, "Look, that's unacceptable. I'm going to veto any effort that comes across my desk like that." So he's been very strong on the life issue, but throughout this year, we've had to work hard to make sure that our issues, the values issues, as we talk about them, really, the issues that we are fighting for here at FRC, defending life, defending family, defending religious freedom, to make sure those issues are protected in the appropriations bills that come out of Congress. because there's a lot of little sneaky ways that language can be inserted. Little text here, just one line sometimes, can hook multi-millions of dollars in a different direction and cause it to fund some things that we would all have a problem with. Just one little change in hundreds, thousands of pages of text can result in millions more funding going to something that we work towards. You know, so we often think in terms of the law as blocking something, allowing something. But here we're talking about our tax money going towards funding either good measures, good provisions, or bad provisions. So that's why the appropriations process is important. President Trump's been very strong in this. And throughout this year, we've fought to maintain these good provisions, we've had allies, and this administration has been one of them. And thankfully, they've held the line, resulting in a pretty good appropriations package, which finally just passed the Senate today, which will avoid a government shutdown at least until next year. We funded the government, and this is success in terms of protecting our issues for the most part.
So House Democrats didn't just take an attempt, sort of a stab at the Mexico City policy, but there were some other pretty radical anti-family provisions that were sort of snuck in through the back door. And of course, it relies on all of us sitting down and reading the appropriations bills word for word, because as you said, this is the difference between millions and billions of dollars. So what else did they attempt to change?
Yeah. I mean, we have a whole list of provisions that we're looking for every year, you know, in a host of different bills here, funding different parts of the government, DHS, DOD, HHS, State Department. All these bills, there's the constant threat of language being inserted that will violate religious freedom, whether by inserting sexual orientation, gender identity requirements in various areas of the law, or even causing people to violate their conscience on the abortion issue, on life. There's a host. I mean, I could sit here and rattle these off, but I mean, there's a host of bad provisions, and many of these were in the House bills earlier this year. Bills come out of the House. We monitor these and track and score the votes earlier last spring. A number of votes on our issue. So, to your question, the House Democrats, it wasn't just the Mexico City policy. It was a host of our issues. They passed bad bills out. Thankfully, they were unacceptable in the Senate. The administration had a problem with them. We communicated this to the administration. Said these are things we care about. I think that's also part of this story. As we see, as this process came together in the last week or so, the powerful voice of the values groups aligning together and coalescing into a unified voice saying this is unacceptable to us, violations or compromises on the life issue, family, religious freedom. The administration and Senate and House leadership or the Senate leadership, House minority leadership heard that message. They understood it. You know, so in all the voices they're hearing, they know that Christian communities across America, people who care about our issues, life, family, religious freedom, they know that these people are watching what the administration is doing, what Congress is doing. And I think that message got through because our issues were largely protected. I mean, this I think is very significant when we look at the political setup in terms of Christians supporting the administration and the Republican Party in terms of life, family, religious liberty. They're doing a good thing right now, and they know that, and it's important that we keep communicating that.
Well, and it runs the gamut. Like you said, this is funding for the entirety of the government. That includes every agency, multiple provisions. So thanks to you and your team here at FRC and those we work with in that on Capitol Hill, one of the many provisions we talked about, Democrat Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire tried to sneak in bad language into the state and foreign appropriations bill, those that would increase organizational funding for groups that promote abortions overseas. We're talking conscience protections being potentially rolled back. So we really appreciate the work that you do because it sounds like just money, but it's money that goes to some pretty awful programs if we're not on top of it.
These are important issues. And you mentioned that the Values Action Team in the House and Senate, we work with them closely on these issues to block things like the Shaheen Amendment, which was going to violate a lot, you know, it caused problems for a lot of our concerns. So that was one of the recent successes in getting that rolled back. So a lot to celebrate and appreciate in terms of the Senate leadership on this and the Republicans in the House and the administration doing good work on this.
FRC's Travis Weber has been my guest today. Coming up next, it's yet another school bathroom story, but we're going to talk to one Christian father of four girls who was up in arms about the fact that a boy identifying as a girl was able to use his daughter's restrooms. We'll be right back.
The topic of sexual sin can be difficult to discuss in the church, but it's something that needs to be addressed. To help inform this conversation, FRC has a new publication for church leaders called Safeguard Your Ministry from Moral Failure. In it, Dr. Jesse Gill, a licensed psychologist, specifically addresses sexual sin and the susceptibility of those in church leadership. He discusses the contributing factors to moral failure, a practical understanding of our sexual nature, and a call for Christian leaders to increase their dependency on Christ. The principles found in this publication will instruct leaders in meeting their emotional, relational, and even sexual needs in healthy ways so that there will be less of a foothold for temptation. Safeguard Your Ministry for Moral Failure is a must-read for everyone involved in church ministry. To read the publication and learn more, visit frc.org/safeguard. That's frc.org/safeguard.
Are you a parent of a school-aged child? If so, then you understand that navigating your educational system is one of the biggest challenges facing families across the United States today. Family Research Council's new publication titled The SPLC's Teaching Tolerance, What Parents, Teachers, and Administrators Need to Know, helps parents identify and monitor a specific agenda that is being pushed on their children in public schools. The highly partisan left-wing Southern Poverty Law Center is one of the greatest offenders on this front with their program titled Teaching Tolerance. This program is designed to infiltrate schools with radically progressive education resources that undermine Christian values about marriage and family. FRC's brochure outlines the content within the SPLC's Teaching Tolerance Project and empowers parents to protect their children against the SPLC's agenda. Learn more at frc.org/teachingtolerance. That's frc.org/teachingtolerance.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. You can make a donation to our annual year-end matching campaign and find out more information about today's stories and guests. Well, in North Manchester, Indiana, a child who was born a boy but identifies as a girl is being allowed to use the girls' bathroom at the elementary school. And that is, as you can imagine, not going over well with parents. One of those parents is Nate Gephardt, an electrician who owns Maven Electric and has two elementary-age daughters. He called the principal as well as the superintendent to register his very strong objection. Joining me now is Nate himself, a father who has refused to stand on the sidelines. Nate, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So how did you first hear that a boy was being allowed to go into the girls' bathrooms where your daughters might be?
Yeah, so someone reached out to me, and through the educational system here in town, and had mentioned it to me, and that's how I found out, and that's when I contacted the school about it.
So you find this out, you decide immediately you're going to talk to the principal and the superintendent, Teresa Grimaud. What did you say to her when you talked to her?
Well, I asked them both. I've called the principal first, excuse me, and I said, hey, you know, what's going on here, you know? And I asked a serious question, and they confirmed that it was going on. It was going on. It was done in secret. No one was told about it. No one in our community knew about it. And they just said, well, we're just following the law. We're just following Title IX. And so I said, well, let me ask you a question. What if you have a teacher who's a biological male, and over the summer he wants to transition, become a female? Is that teacher then allowed to use my little girl's bathroom? And she said, I know, Nate, I know. And I said, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me. And I got the exact same response from Superintendent Grimaud here in North Manchester, Indiana, the exact same response. And I said, that's unacceptable, completely unacceptable. We're supposed to be sending our kids to a safe place. And
right.
This is a violation of every kid's safety and privacy rights in our school system.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. I am the mother of three in public school myself, and I will tell you, I would also be up in arms, particularly because in this instance, we are talking elementary school. Normally, what we see in terms of these conflicts and the controversies are taking place at high schools across America, but this is an elementary school. So you decided to set up a Facebook page. You ran a petition. Where are you now with your petition signatures?
Yeah, I haven't checked in the last couple of days, but I think we're over 1,000 petition, and it's went, you know, not just here locally, but we had over 450 here signatures here in our town and the surrounding small towns that pool into our school system. So, you know, parents are putting their foot down and just saying, enough is enough. We've had enough of this. We're so tired of political correctness. Listen, we love people. We love everyone, mm-hmm. and we accept everyone. But the problem with people today is they blur the line of accepting people and accepting ideology. We've got to end accepting people's ideology, even if we're called haters. Jesus said, they hated me, they're going to hate you. If people aren't hating you right now because you're a Christian, then I ask you, what are you doing? If you're not being persecuted, then what are you doing? We can go about and live our comfortable lives and just be comfortable. But when we stand before Jesus Christ and look him in the eye, is he going to be happy? Is he going to say, well done, my good and faithful servant? Or is he going to say, why didn't you stand up and speak out? Why were you silent?
Amen, Nate. In fact, as someone who spoke out, and I commend you for this, last night at a subsequent meeting, you packed out a room with 300 parents wearing white to demonstrate the purity of kids. So tell me about that meeting. What was it like?
Yeah, it was pretty packed. There was people from both sides. You know, I want to be honest. You know, it wasn't all packed out in white, but it was full. Honestly, we were set up by our school board and we were set up by our superintendent. We had a school board meeting on the 10th and we were shut down. They said, we do not want bathroom policy conversation here tonight at a public meeting.
Ugh.
So I actually spoke about policy, but I respected their wishes and I did not talk about the bathroom issue because they said, we're going to hold a special meeting on the 18th for you. Then we can all talk. Well, they set us up. They had lawyers there. You know, telling us why this was implemented. And it's not a policy, by the way. It's just a practice. So they're calling it a practice.
Sure.
Thanks for practicing this.
Also,
on our kids,
also fungible terms that don't have any legal applicability.
There is no law. There's no federal law and there's no state law that requires a school to allow a transgender child to use the bathroom of their choice that they identify with. People are, if you look into it, the Obama administration sent out a Dear Colleague letter in 2016 demanding that schools do this. In 2017, February 22nd, 2017, the Trump administration revoked and rescinded that letter. So it is not the law.
Nate, I am so glad to have had you on Washington Watch today. 7 school board members, but only 3 are conservative. So quick question as we close out this segment. Will you consider running for school board?
I don't want to, but I'll consider it. I want to be obedient, but I would consider it, yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Nate Gebhardt from Manchester, Indiana, has been my great guest today. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, we've spent lots of money, we've had lots of involvement, and the most recent iteration, Common Core. But what have our education scores done with all that federal intervention? Well, I'll talk next with Lindsay Burke, a Heritage Foundation fellow, who'll reveal why we need to get the government out of schools. Coming up next.
News. We can get it from many sources, but what can you trust these days? Where can you get news that doesn't make you as suspicious as you are informed? If you're looking for something better, for honest coverage of the latest news, one trusted news source I look to is the Washington Times. When preparing for the radio program and selecting guests to join me on the show, I will often read the Washington Times and have their reporters join me here on the program because I trust how they cover the news. Join me and more than 7 million readers who turn to the Washington Times every month to get real, trusted news. For a limited time only, listeners of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins will receive a special annual rate of $69.95 for the first year. Subscribe to the Washington Times and get this special offer by using my name and visiting washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins. That's washingtontimes.com/Tony Perkins.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C. I want to invite you to join Luana and myself, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through June the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Sarah Perry here, sitting in for Tony Perkins. TonyPerkins.com. Why is that important? Because it's got information about today's programming, but as we approach the end of the year, it's how you can help us partner in 2020 to make a difference. When you give before the 31st of December, your gift will be doubled thanks to a generous year-end challenge match to help us advance faith, family, and freedom for the sake of America here in the nation's capital and beyond. Go to TonyPerkins.com. Well, over the past two decades, while federal policymakers were busy enacting a multitude of federal laws, creating mandates for local school leaders, and increasing the Department of Education's budget from $38 billion in 2000 to, now this is unadjusted for inflation, roughly $70 billion today, the math and reading performance of American high school kids has completely remained flat. Well, I laugh because I think this is what those conservative and sane thinking pundits among us were saying all along. More money, more bureaucracy, more centralization does not answer our problems. So joining me now with her analysis is Lindsay Burke, a Heritage Foundation fellow who has written repeatedly on the subject of education, and most recently has a Daily Signal piece. Lindsay, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so American kids, we are now scoring better in the category of reading, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, but there's kind of a catch. Can you explain what the catch is?
Unfortunately, there is a little catch. It's not, unfortunately, because the U.S. is actually improving its reading achievement. It's because other countries have seen declines in their reading achievement. So, and, you know, unfortunately, the story gets worse, too, because in mathematics, the U.S. has, in fact, actually declined their performance levels over the past two decades. So it's a pretty unfortunate story all around, no matter how you slice the data.
And, in fact, the New York Times just had a report. Dana Goldstein wrote that about a fifth of American 15-year-olds, and I have a 15-year-old, scored so low on the PISA test that it appeared they had not mastered reading skills expected of a 10-year-old. To say abysmal, again, I'm sort of confounded by the understatements with which I'm stuck here during the show, but there really is no other description for how bad this stagnation is. So
abysmal is definitely right. To have a fifth of American 15-year-olds reading at the level of a 10-year-old, to have really just persistent academic achievement gaps between children from low-income families and more affluent families, and to just in general have educational stagnation persist for basically a half century now, it really, to use your word, is abysmal. And when you couple that with the amount of spending that we have poured into our K-12 education system over the past four or five decades, I mean, just since the 1960s, we have seen per pupil spending quadruple, and that's inflation-adjusted spending. To see those levels of spending increase fourfold and to have flat outcomes, I think really tells just an uninspiring story that really does require us to think about how we change the way that families are currently accessing education.
Well, we know, for example, that the spending per pupil has quadrupled, but what are we looking at in terms of dollars and cents? What are we spending right now on American kids in public education?
Yeah, so right now we spend, if you add federal, state, and local dollars together, we spend about $13,000 per child per year.
And wow.
It's really a phenomenal amount of money. And when you poll people, you know, just average people across the country and ask them what they think we spend per pupil, it gets way underestimated, something by, you know, $6,000, where people think we're spending $6,000 less per pupil on average than we actually are. So it's around $13,000 per pupil per year. And if you think about what that means over a 13-year schooling period, right, a kid going through kindergarten and then graduating high school, you know, $13,000 over 13 years per pupil, we're talking $160,000 plus to get a child from kindergarten to high school graduation. We're spending a breathtaking amount of money and unfortunately are just not seeing outcomes improve the way that we would like.
Now, I want to add an angle to this because recently Phi Delta Kappa, which is an organization that tracks sort of community responses to things like this, educational data, just reported with a randomized sample that the majority of respondents were claiming that the biggest problem facing public schools in their communities was a lack of funding. Now, this is a 2019 report that just came out. It's stunning to me that even though we've been spending this much money, the average person thinks that the problem with education and with our scores and with our international competitiveness is still money. Why do we persist in this belief?
Yeah, you know, and that's right. And we spend really at almost the very top of the pack when you look internationally at what other countries are spending. We're outspent by one or two countries. I think Luxembourg outspends us. But we really are on a per pupil level spending almost more than any other country in the world. And again, you know, if you just look in terms of real dollars, inflation-adjusted spending, in 1970, we were spending about $4,700 per pupil. Today, again, it's over $13,000 per pupil. I mean, we've just seen tremendous increases. And, you know, I think people might not realize the extent to which we're increasing spending because so much of that spending gets trapped in the schooling bureaucracy that has proliferated since the 1960s. There's more and more work now coming out on this, but if you just look from 1960 to today, in public schools across the country, we saw about a 40% increase in the number of students nationally in our public schools since 1960, but at the same time, we saw a 137% increase in the number of non-teaching administrative staff.
Oh, and yikes. So we're hiring more people in the schools.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. More people, flat scores, more money. So it doesn't seem as if the Department of Education has yet cracked the code on how to get at the root of this problem. Another problem, and you've addressed this, is the achievement gap between students. So not just dollar per dollar on students, but the difference between high-performing and low-performing kids. Why does that matter?
Yeah, and that matters so much. We've recently put out a book called The Not-So-Great Society, but that was really an indictment of the education component of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society efforts, the War on Poverty.
Sure.
And a big goal, at least the articulated goal that President Johnson had in doing this, was to provide more opportunity for low-income individuals and to narrow those opportunity gaps. Well, we've spent, at the K-12 level alone, $2 trillion since the War on Poverty launched. And remember, this is just at the federal level, just on these War on Poverty programs. And yet, we have not seen a narrowing of the achievement gap. If you look at new work by Paul Peterson at Harvard and Eric Hanushek at Stanford, they identified a learning gap that's the equivalent of 4 grade levels worth of learning between children from the poorest families and wealthier families. That gap of 4 years worth of learning was what existed in the 1960s. Today, it is still 4 grade levels worth of learning. So all of this spending, and we have not moved the needle whatsoever on narrowing that achievement gap.
Lindsay, I laugh because I think, you know, I'm too embarrassed to cry on air. So
yes.
I have to tell you, here, of course, the most recent iteration of all this federal intervention, all of this money, all of these bureaucratic hires, as we know, and you've studied this as well as the Common Core State Standards, and we were told it would bring us up to international parity with our counterparts, and it would make us all prepared for the future. And for those of us like me, who wrote and studied the issue exclusively for the better part of a year and did nothing but Common Core when I was initially hired, I got to tell you, we knew that this was a Marxist educational theory, but now we have actual data because it didn't work, did it?
Yeah, it didn't work. And, you know, it's so interesting to think about that history of federal intervention, and that's exactly what it is in education policy, really with the high watermark being Common Core. And if you look at when Johnson initiated the Great Society, he said, here's a few additional federal dollars. We'll try not to be too prescriptive. Well, that changed very quickly. We got a standards-based reform movement in the 1990s that ultimately wound up with No Child Left Behind in 2001, laying the groundwork. And then the Obama administration comes in and says, we are now going to try to dictate what is taught in schools across the country. It was significant, heavy-handed federal intervention that 44 states adopted from the very beginning.
Right.
And yet now we have all the data to suggest that that certainly didn't help and probably made things much, much worse.
Well, and not that I would ever quote Canada for policy reform or suggestions on how to run a government, but you pointed out that Canadian students, our neighbors to the north, are performing incredibly well on the PISA, which is Program for International Student Assessment, since 2000. Why are they outpacing the U.S.?
Yeah, it's really interesting to think that we have our neighbor to the north so close to us geographically with an education system that is so different from how we run ours, and different in a good way. It's totally decentralized. Canada has 10 provinces that each set their own education policy. Not only did Canada not go with national standards at any time, but they don't even have a national department of education the way that we do. And so I think that there's a lesson to be learned there, that Canada's system is incredibly decentralized, and they consistently outperform us on these international measures.
So you mentioned previously the book, The Not-So-Great Society, just recently released, and you talked about some of the reasons that large-scale governmental programs and education consistently fail. So talk to me about some of those reasons.
Yeah, and this is something we drew on the good work that Yuval Levin has done in this area, where he says that these large-scale programs fail because the administrative state is just inefficient, it's unresponsive, and really antithetical to our age of what he calls endless choice and variety. And then he also points out that, you know, just culturally and morally, that this idea that there should be a government effort to sort of rescue children from, you know, the burdens of responsibility is not going to work, that we need to go and remain down the path of self-government. And then in general, he just says that, you know, large-scale federal programs are unaffordable, you know, and he has a line about, you know, they're dependent on dubious economics and a demographic model of a bygone era, talking about the fact that we used to put in a lot more than we take out. Now the inverse is the case. And so, you know, pretty straightforward identification of the problem with large-scale government programs, that they're unaffordable and they are far removed from the individuals that ostensibly they're designed to serve. And I think at the end of the day, that's just it. You know, do you as a family want to be the one making these most important decisions about how and where your children are educated?
Right.
Or do we expect some distant federal policymaker to do that?
Well, and in certain respects, I think we as the parents are to blame for certain developments like this, because the government keeps getting bigger and we keep handing over the reins of our parents' education to Washington elites, which for me, again, as a parent with three in public school, I find incredibly frustrating. So you believe that federal government is the sort of worst place to dictate educational theory. Why is that?
Yeah. You know, fundamentally, it is that it's so far removed from the students that these policies impact and from the families, but also just structurally, it's not the appropriate level for education governance. If you kind of take a big step back and think about how we finance K-12 education in the U.S., the federal government actually has a pretty small share in the financing. It finances about 8.5% of everything that we spend on K-12 ed. So despite the fact that we've spent a lot of money, the federal portion of that is 8.5%. Most of the funding that we spend to finance K-12 education is state and locally derived. It's about a 45-45 split. And so purely from a that's where the money is perspective, when we are talking about policy reforms, so much of that has to happen at the state and local level because that's where the financing is. And so there's that piece. And just, you know, at the end of the day, if you crack open your Constitution, you will not find the word education. It is simply not an enumerated power of the federal government.
No, it's not. And people have advocated for the abolition of the Department of Education for as long as I can remember ever reading about the issue. Are you a proponent of that view?
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly something that I think we can thoughtfully at this time really think about how to achieve. We now have half a century of evidence from the Great Society that large-scale federal programs have failed. The Department of Ed, of course, didn't come on board until 1980. Actually, this year in May will be the 40-year anniversary of it being in operation. Mm. So we now have about 40 years worth of data that the Department of Education as a cabinet-level agency has not achieved the types of improvements proponents said it would achieve. So I definitely think we are at the point now where we should fundamentally reconsider education as a cabinet-level agency of the federal government.
Lindsay Burke, fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Education. I so wish we had more time. What a great discussion and a reminder that big government is never the answer. I've been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday afternoon. Merry Christmas to you all from those of us at Washington Watch, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action,
For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.